From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Dennis Hopper stars as an international art collector in the new movie Basquiat. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, Hopper talks about his own passion for art collecting and how that connects to his work as an actor. He's collected contemporary art since the early 60s, when he was still doing TV shows like Sugarfoot, The Rifleman, and The Defenders. Also, roots rock performer Dave Alvin shows off another side of his work, his poetry. Alvin played in the bands The Blasters and X. Now he has his first live solo album. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews a new novel by criminal lawyer Paula Sharp. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Americans have been spending more than they earn, according to the economic figures for July released by the Commerce Department today. John Riding is a senior economist at Bear Stearns.
Consumer confidence is very high. We're at a six-year high. We've seen very strong gains in July and August, which is why I don't think the indicators of soft income and spending are any fundamental indication of what's happening in the U.S. economy.
The government says a key measure of the nation's manufacturing strength rose nearly 2% in July. That's the fourth advance in the last 5 months, and orders for durable goods jumped 1.7%. President Clinton accepted his party's nomination last night in Chicago, vowing to bring America into a new century of promise. Opportunity and responsibility were the themes of the evening as Mr. Clinton made his case for re-election. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Standing before the most dedicated members of his party, President Clinton declared that hope is back in America and the country is on the right track. In an hour-long speech, the president laid out the challenges ahead and a laundry list of proposals to help working families meet them. Of his opponent's tax cut plan, he asked the crowd, "Do we really want to make the same mistake again, pile up a mountain of debt, and weaken the bridge to the 21st century?"
We should cut taxes for the family, sending a child to college, for the worker returning to college, for the family saving to buy a home or for long-term health care, and a $500 per child credit for middle-income families raising their children who need help with child care and what the children will do after school.
It's all paid for, he declared, line by line, dime by dime. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Chicago.
Bosnia is scheduled to have elections in a little more than 2 weeks now, a stepping stone, the U.S. hopes, to democracy and ethnic peace in the war-torn country. This week, however, municipal elections were postponed indefinitely amid reports of intimidation. And now GOP presidential nominee Bob Dole is urging President Clinton to call for a postponement of other elections as well. Barry Schwide has more.
When the United States and the European allies drew up a blueprint last year for democracy and peace in Bosnia, free and fair elections were at the top of the list. There were doubts then, there probably are more now, that the elections can conform to Western standards. Registration rolls have been packed, especially by Serbs, which led to this week's cancellation of municipal elections. But while Dole, some leading politicians in Bosnia, and some Europeans see the elections as a sham, the Clinton administration, on balance, still thinks they ought to go forward as scheduled September 14th. Even faulty elections are considered better than none and are considered an important first step to bringing democracy to Bosnia. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schwide at the State Department.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 35.5 points. The NASDAQ Composite Index is down 3.5. This is NPR News. Residents along the East Coast are keeping a wary eye on Hurricane Edouard as they prepare for the long holiday weekend. The powerful storm is still hundreds of miles out in the Atlantic, but forecasters are not sure if it will continue its turn away from land. According to the New York Times, federal investigators have conducted a computer simulation of the final moments of TWA Flight 800, which indicates the explosion likely began in a small area of the passenger cabin above a wing. From New York, NPR's Melissa Block reports.
Citing unnamed sources, the New York Times reports the area pinpointed in the computer simulation also shows physical evidence of an explosion. The Times says there are fist-sized holes punched through the backs of two passenger seats from the right end of row 23 above the plane's center fuel tank. Yesterday, National Transportation Safety Board Chairman Robert Francis said only that seats above the center tank showed more fire damage than other parts of the plane. The Suffolk County Medical Examiner has now positively identified two more victims. One is Czech pilot Steven Snyder, the last of the four cockpit crew to be identified. The other is Monica Weaver, the last of the 16 students from Montoursville, Pennsylvania, to be recovered. The FBI has asked beachgoers along the eastern seaboard to be on the lookout for floating personal effects from victims of the crash. The FBI asks anyone finding such pieces to contact the local police department. I'm Melissa Block in New York.
Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat's second showdown with the Israeli government in as many days was less successful than the first. Arafat had called on large numbers of Palestinians to pray at a mosque in Jerusalem today. 15,000 people turned out, but that's fewer than usual for a Friday. Muslim clerics blamed the low turnout on Israeli troops who set up roadblocks to turn away Palestinians trying to reach the mosque. Israeli police insist they did not keep anyone away who had a permit to enter the country. Yesterday, some 2 million Palestinians took part in a half-day strike to protest Israel's planned expansion of Jewish settlements in the West Bank and Gaza. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new film Basquiat is based on the life of the artist Jean-Michel Basquiat, who went from graffiti writer to art world star before dying in 1988 at the age of 27. Dennis Hopper is featured in the film as the international art dealer Bruno Bischofberger. It's not surprising Hopper was chosen for the part. Hopper has collected contemporary art for over 30 years. He's also a painter and photographer. Last April, we talked about his involvement with the visual arts and how that relates to his acting career. Hopper told me he connects his interest in painting to his boyhood in Kansas.
Kansas was a very flat place, so I wanted to know where the trains were going and what a mountain looked like, what a skyscraper looked like, what the ocean looked like. And years later, I thought that I think it's one of the reasons I became so interested in the visual aspects of things, because that horizon line, when I finally saw the ocean when I was 13 years old, I saw my first mountain when I came to Colorado when I was 13 on the way to California. I was really disappointed. My mountains that I'd imagined were so much bigger. And I got to California and I saw the ocean. It was the same horizon line that I'd seen on the wheat field. And I thought, wow, this is not what I'd imagined, you know. I don't know what I thought. I thought you could see all the way to China or something, or it'd look different. It'd be a different angle. But it was the same horizon line. And I think that then I saw my first skyscraper, not as big as I'd imagined. I always thought that, like, my imagination had been developed quite. was a little out of whack. You know, my buildings were bigger, my mountains were bigger, and the ocean was bigger in my imagination than in reality. So.
Well, when you started taking photographs, did you want the size of buildings and the size of mountains to be as big as they had been in your memory from movies, or did you want them to be as real as reality was, even though that was often disappointing?
Yeah, well, you know, what I did was I became an actor when I was 18 years. I started acting at the Old Globe Theater in San Diego when I was 13, and doing Shakespeare and doing all that. So when I was 18 years old, I moved from I moved from San Diego to Los Angeles, and in a short amount of time, I got a contract at Warner Brothers. I was still 18 years old. I just graduated from high school, and I was now under contract to Warner Brothers, and I was doing Rebel Without a Cause. And when I was 19, I did Giant with Rock Hudson, Elizabeth Taylor, and James Dean. So during that period of time, everybody was photographing me. So when I started taking photographs, which was in this period of time, I'd already been a painter. And I started taking photographs, not of people, but of walls and of things where I had no depth of field. I would shoot flat on, so I had a painting surface. So I'd shoot flat on a wall or flat on something, and it would become like the surface of a painting. So that was my early beginnings of photography in the early 50s. And then I went through a Cartier-Bresson decisive moment period when I came to study with Lee Strasberg in New York, which is where you catch something in action. guy's throwing a ball, it's just before he catches the ball, or somebody's walking over a puddle, which is a famous saying, he's got his foot up just before his foot hits the water, or whatever. It's a moment where you see with a still camera when to push the shutter and when to catch that decisive moment that will make it a photograph. So I went through a period of that when I was in New York. And then a friend of mine, because I was hanging around art galleries, you know, I always, some people went to the beach and became beach bums, and some became tennis bums, some became ski bums. I became an art gallery bum, and I just hung around art galleries because there were so many people involved in making movies, so many different departments and everything, that I thought an artist, a painter, a solitary kind of creator that could create by himself, that was more more interesting to me than all the people around movies. You know, so many people, so many creative people.
Now, what was your first exposure to art? Was there any art around when you were growing up? And I'd even be interested in hearing if your parents or grandparents had, you know, tacky, kitschy things that they decorated the house with.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I drew when I was a kid, and I studied at the Nelson Art Gallery on weekends. They had an underprivileged children's art class.
Were you an underprivileged child?
Well, I got in there. Yeah, I was. I slipped in. So at that time, I was in a drawing class, and I was doing a little watercolor like I'd learned in Dodge City. And this man came up to me, and he said, what are you doing? And I said, well, I'm painting this rock and river and so on. And he said, well, son, he said, I don't know how to tell you this, but someday you're going to have to get tight and paint loose. Yeah. And this man was, God, I'm trying to think of his name, kind of just slipped his name right out, but he was Jackson Pollock's teacher. He was, this is going to drive me crazy. Thomas Hart Benton. Thomas Hart Benton, yeah. He taught me, taught Pollock. Anyway, I studied there, and I found that I would go into the theater and draw the actors.
The movie theater or stage theater?
Stage theater, mm-hmm. Where they were rehearsing plays, and I'd sketch the actors. And so that was sort of my beginning of my art career. And when I arrived in Los Angeles, I had worked at La Jolla Playhouse, and my friend who was my boss there, he was an interior designer, and he was working with Mary Price, Vincent Price's wife, who was an interior designer. They had a kiln where they did tile work at Vincent's house, and I went up there and made some tiles. And that's where I saw, Vincent was an art collector, and that's where I saw my first friends, Klein, my first Jackson Pollocks, my first de Koonings, and so on. We're at his house. And I'd been painting abstractly, but I'd never really thought that anybody really painted abstractly until I saw these things.
Now, it must have been interesting to be exposed to your first abstract art through somebody's private collection as opposed to through a museum.
Yeah.
Did that, in a way encourage you to later become a collector? I mean, because it was part of how you were first exposed to it. I know you collect a lot of art.
Yeah. Well, Vincent gave me a painting, actually, when I was about, I was 19 or 20. Vincent gave me a small painting. I don't even remember who it was by now. Mm-hmm. And I said, I know that that you're probably going to be a collector, so let me start you off.
Gee, how nice.
And then when I got my first money, I did start collecting art. And, it's like a compulsion. I was thinking about the other day, I think that, you know, I don't have a formula where I go to the right dealer and buy the right painting. I've been very fortunate to seem to have an eye. I bought Andy Warhol's for a soup can painting, hand-painted for $70.
When was it? Is it?
That was like 1963, I believe.
Why did you want it? What spoke to you about the painting? What did it?
The first time America had an art form of its own was abstract expressionism. We'd always imitated the Europeans before that. And rather than drawing a mountain and saying, I'm not going to draw a mountain, or I'm going to draw a tree, or I'm going to draw this wonderful face of this person, abstract expressionist says we're going to use paint as paint. We're not going to draw anything. We're going to make a brush stroke, and that's going to be the painting. And it's going to be action. It's going to be done with action. So we're not going to have time to think and preconceive a lot of stuff. We're just going to use our motion and use the action of painting itself and make that become the design and the pattern. And the motion of the canvas and so on. So this changed the whole way that everybody looked at art, and America suddenly had its own art form. And after you get into second and third generation, there's usually about 12 or 13 people who form the nucleus of a group. I mean, in the abstract expressions, there was Jackson Pollock and Franz Kline and de Kooning and Gottlieb and, I don't know, I guess, there's Motherwell. And there were about 10 or 12 guys and women. That's sort of the way it's been through the history of art, through Dada and Surrealism. And they just suddenly crop up, and all these people are suddenly painting abstractly. They didn't have a meeting somewhere and said, let's all paint abstractly. But for some reason, they followed the history of art, and the next step seems to have been obvious to them, and they start doing it.
As somebody who was so attracted to abstraction, what interested you in the idea of something representational, of a little commercial object?
That's
like
what I'm really, I know I'm beating around the bush. That's what I'm trying to get to. So at a certain point, if you're collecting art or involved in it, you suddenly see the third generation people are now imitating. It's like looking at Remington or Russell, the great Western painters, and suddenly now you see Western artists imitating those things. It's not original anymore, it's just an imitation. Well, when you have an original art form like abstract expressionism, you get third generation abstract expressionism imitating the first ones and trying to find their own way. The critics started talking about, what is the return to reality going to be? When are we going to return to reality? Now, at that time, there was a group of painters in San Francisco called the Bay Area Figurative Painters, and there was David Parks and Elmer Bischoff and Richard Diebenkorn and Nathan Oliveira, whatever. And they were using abstract expressionist terms, and they were going back and using the figure. And I looked at this, and I said, no, this is good painting, but this has already been done. So Teen had done this before in France, before abstract expressionism. This couldn't be the return to reality, because they're using old forms to return to reality. It doesn't make sense to me. So when I saw my first soup can painting, and I saw my first by Andy Warhol, and I saw my first cartoon paintings by Roy Lichtenstein, and I saw the billboard paintings of Rosenquist, and I saw Oldenburg's giant hamburgers and so on, I realized that this was the return to reality, that this was the comic book and the soup can and the Coca-Cola bottle of Jasper Johns and so on, Rauschenberg, and these guys were coming back to reality with a whole new set of things. I mean, before pop art, as we know it, popular art, commercial art, came into being, the largest lithograph was just a 2-foot by 3-foot piece of paper. Then suddenly we could use, there was Rosenquist, and suddenly we could do what commercial art could do. We can make lithographs the size of billboards, and Ed Keenhall showed us that we could take things off the wall and we could make rooms and environment, and Rosenquist took the square and the rectangle and broke the surface for the first time in 1961, and suddenly we had different shaped canvases, and suddenly there was hard edge, and it went on and on, and it was a wonderful, wonderful life I've had in art, because I've seen so many different things happen and develop.
Now, if you bought this soup can painting in about 63, that was, I think, about the time about the end of the time that you'd been doing a lot of episodic television. Because you were on a lot of the TV shows and Sugarfoot, Wagon Train, The Rifleman, Cheyenne, Studio One, Zane Grey Theater, Naked City, The Defenders. Did you feel like you were in two really different worlds? You know, because the art world that you were living in was a world in which things were changing, and there was a lot of intellectual thinking behind the paintings. Sometimes that thinking might have been more expressed by the critics than the painters themselves, but there was a lot of thinking behind all of this. And you were doing TV shows that were, some of them were really pretty formulaic. I mean, they certainly weren't, intellectual expressions of their time.
No, yeah.
So was it like living in two different worlds?
It was strange because I was doing what I consider sophisticated work as an actor.
As an actor, yeah.
But at the same time, and the television at the time was very formula kind of stuff. But I'd also been in Rebel Without a Cause,
right,
which was sort of a far out flick of the day and very successful. I'd done a film called Night Night Tide, which we'd made for $25,000, Curtis Harrington and I, and we'd shot it in the streets, and it became in the Cinematheque in Paris, and it was well received, but we couldn't get it distributed because we'd made it non-union. So I was doing this television, starring in these television shows, but I was also living this other life. I was helping Andy Warhol make his first films, which is totally had nothing to do with any kind of professional kind of thing, but just sort of setting up a camera and watching the Empire State Building and reloading the film every year, you know.
I had no idea you were a part of that. So you work with Paul Morrissey and Andy Warhol?
Yeah, in the very, very beginnings of it. I did his first film with him called Tarzan and Jane Revisited, which he shot out in Los Angeles. Andy had his first shows in Los Angeles and Roy Lichtenstein. They didn't have them in New York. They were shown at the Ferris Gallery in Los Angeles.
Huh.
And a lot of this was because Marcel Duchamp had the only retrospective he had in his life was in California in 1963 at the Pasadena Museum. A friend of mine, Walter Hopps, gave him a retrospective there. So it brought all the artists out from New York and around the world to Los Angeles suddenly.
No, Marcel Duchamp, I mean, did you read his diaries, his journals?
No, I never did, but I knew him.
You knew Marcel Duchamp?
Yeah.
How'd you meet him?
Well, I met him at his retrospective.
At the retrospective?
Yeah, all of us sort of did.
You didn't play chess with him, did you?
Actually, I did. Yeah,
you did? Yeah.
Not for very long.
So
he was really good.
What was it like to play chess with Marcel Duchamp? I mean, there's like, John Cage has talked about that too, about how he loved to play chess with Duchamp. That was a big thing for Duchamp.
Well, I sat down at a table with him for about 3 minutes. It was a thrill, okay?
Right,
but
right,
I don't
right.
know what moves I made or what he did, right, you know, except right. that I was thrilled by it. And that was the same day he was playing. There's a famous photograph of him sitting with playing chess with a nude, and that was in Pasadena.
We're featuring an interview recorded earlier this year with Dennis Hopper. He plays an international art dealer in the new film Basquiat. We'll hear more from Hopper after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Dennis Hopper. You've been collecting art for a long time. I think it was in like 1961 that your home burned down in a fire.
In the Bel Air fire.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, did that discourage you from collecting? Because you lost, well, I don't know exactly what you lost, but I imagine just about everything you owned. Though I know your photographs had been touring and had been in an exhibition, so they were saved
them,
but
yeah.
I mean, I think a lot of people would think, well, what's the point of collecting when objects you own can be so ephemeral.
Yeah, well, I lost over 300 of my own paintings. I had a studio in the garage, so it all burnt down, so I lost all my paintings. I did have a photographic show that night that opened, so my negatives from my photographs are saved. In the house itself, I was married to Brooke Hayward. All I had really at that time, my ex-wife Brooke lost all of her mother's, Margaret Sullivan's, furniture that she had in the house. And my father had fought with Mao across China. He was in the OSS, Office of Strategic Services, and he had been one of the people that took the surrender from the Japanese in Peiping and then left them armed till Chiang Kai-shek could come and take over so that Mao didn't take the country so quickly. However, he did collect some things when he had this three-month period of time that he was going back between Mao and the Japanese to get some artifacts out of China, and he bought these beautiful tapestries and things that he'd brought back from the Second World War. Unfortunately, I lost all those in that fire. And when I came out of the thing, the only painting that my wife had at the time was a Milton Avery, and the only thing that I saved out of the house was the Milton Avery. I carried it out on my back as the house was burning down. So it gave us an opportunity, you know, when you lose everything, you have to start over again. And at that time is when I started collecting. I had some money to, like, start collecting, and I started buying pop art. Well, I fell into it right at that moment. I saw my first Soup Can painting. I saw my first Lichtensteins. My agent came in and looked at these things, a soup can painting, this mannequin on a roller skate picking her nose, and this big wood black and white construction abstract thing, and he said, you're wasting your life, you're wasting your money, your wife's money and your money, and if you don't stop this foolishness, you're going to have to look for another agent.
Wow.
And that's when my agent and I parted, and I went on collecting. So it's funny enough.
Now, television, as we mentioned, you were doing a lot of episodic television in the, late 50s,
mm-hmm.
early
mm-hmm.
60s?
Yeah.
What about the best shows to do when you were acting in episodic television? I saw you in the pilot of The Rifleman. You know, they were maybe they still are rerunning it on the Family Channel.
Wow.
It's a really great series. And the episode you're in, you're like the kind of kid gunslinger who comes into town. And
you know who wrote
you're a real show-off in it.
Sam Peckinpah wrote the pilot for...
Yeah, well, he wrote and directed
Rifleman.
A lot of them. Yeah.
He didn't direct it, but he wrote it. But he was there on the set telling me how to play the part. So... But Sam and I had known each other for years. He was the only guy I knew that smoked grass besides me. So we could hide together on the studio lots and smoke a joint every once in a while.
Just one question about marijuana and other drugs. Do you think that they affected your visual sensibility at all, or you know your artistic interests?
Well, you know, first of all, I'm in these 12-step programs because I had a problem. You know, I became a drug addict and mm-hmm. an alcoholic. So I'm sort of torn with this question. I think that I don't think anyone needs them
mm-hmm.
to enhance their visual or intellectual capacities. Does it help? It might in the beginning, open up some doors, you know. But those doors rapidly close if you're a drug addict. And it's not a way of seeing, it's a way of dying. And that's a reality. As far as drinking, I mean, being an alcoholic and a drug addict, it was so easy for me to point to, because I'm an artist, after all, it's okay for me to drink and take drugs because I have an excuse, and being in total denial about the fact that you're an alcoholic and drug addict, because after all, Van Gogh spent a whole summer of drinking to find that yellow. And then at the end of it, I say, well, yeah, he probably couldn't find the tube the yellow was in. He was so drunk. Yeah, but you justify all these things, and it's too easy to justify using drugs and drinking because you're an artist. And I can't cop to that excuse. I can say, yes, in the beginning, everything works. Sex works, drugs works, everything works. If you go too far with it, it becomes... less effective, and then you start working for it rather than it working for you.
Right.
And some of the greatest artists of all time never drank and never took drugs, and that's a reality as much as it is a reality that there a lot of them did, and a lot of them died painfully stupid lives, which they could have been avoided if they hadn't drank and taken drugs.
I really want to thank you a lot for talking with us about your new movie and about art and stuff.
Well, it's always a pleasure. It's great listening to your show.
Dennis Hopper recorded last April. Hopper plays an international art dealer in the new film Basquiat, based on the life of graffiti writer turned art world star Jean-Michel Basquiat. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Roots rock performer Dave Alvin is also quite a good poet. Coming up, he'll read from his collection Any Rough Times Are Now Behind You and tell us about the rough times that inspired the poems. This is music from his new live CD.
In a $30 room next to the airport, I can't hear them jazz through the night. Some people leaving, some people coming home.
blackout's 11 and a woman's earring laying on the table. She said she'd be right back, but I get the feeling she's gone. So I tell myself, one way or another, if she don't come back, there'll just be another who'll believe for a while. I can promise a fool shining through the window of a $30 room. Smoking cigarettes down to the filter, 'cause the pack's running low, and I don't feel like walking outside tonight. I don't feel like anything at all. Looking around the room and wondering who slept here.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Dave Alvin is best known as a blues-influenced singer-songwriter and guitarist. He has several albums under his own name. His first live solo CD has just been released on High Tone Records. It's called Interstate City. Alvin co-founded the roots rock band The Blasters with his brother Phil Alvin, and he recorded with and wrote songs for the group X. Dave Alvin is also a poet, a good one. Last March, we invited him to read from and talk about his new collection of poems, Any Rough Times Are Now Behind You. Before we hear that reading and interview, let's listen back to a song he performed in our studio during his 1994 Fresh Air appearance. Here he is playing his song, Border Radio.
So one more midnight, and her man is still gone. The night moves too slow. She tries to remember the heat of his touch while listening to the border radio. And this song comes from 1962, dedicated to a man who's gone. 50,000 watts out of Mexico, this is the border radio. This is the border radio.
Dave Alvin recruited in the Fresh Air studio in 1994. Okay, let's hear him read from his new book of poems, Any Rough Times Are Now Behind You. This poem is called After We Had Sex.
After we had sex, after she left Virginia for Los Angeles, after she moved in with me, after we lived together for 2 years, after she asked every day if I still loved her, after I told her I did, after her first serious anxiety attack, after she wouldn't get a job, after I quit 2 bands, after I went into debt to keep my own band on the road, after a 300-pound guy wearing a purple negligee jumped in my car while I was waiting for her to come out of a store, kidnapped me at gunpoint, saying, "Just drive and I won't kill you," after I said, "Please don't kill me," after he threw the gun down when we saw a cop, after he and I fought for control of the wheel, after the cop arrested him, after I testified against the 300-pound man and he was sentenced to prison for 2 years, after I went broke and sold off my rare guitars, after I broke up my band, after she had more serious anxiety attacks, after she started seeing a therapist, after we started fighting every day, after we lived in 3 apartments, after we spent 4 days not saying a word to each other, after we stopped having sex, after I cheated on her once, after we started seeing a couples counselor, after an old lover died of AIDS, after we took the AIDS test, after we tested negative, after I spent 2 months living in Nashville, after I was dropped from my record label, after I caught meningitis, after I spent 2.5 weeks in 2 different hospitals, after I didn't get paid for a tour I only did for the money, after her car was stolen, after she worked a succession of receptionist jobs, after she asked every day if I still loved her, after I lied to her every day, after she found a decent job downtown, after guys at her job started asking her out, after we decided there was no reason to stay together, after we looked for 3 months at apartments for her, after she finally found one she liked, after I paid her first and last month's rent plus the security deposit, After I moved her things into her new apartment, after I waited for the gas person, the phone person, the cable TV person, after I told her to call me if she ever needed anything, after she asked me if I still loved her, after I lied one last time, after I left her alone in her new apartment, after I ate dinner alone that night at a Chinese restaurant, after I opened my fortune cookie, my fortune read, "Any rough times are now behind you."
That's Dave Alvin reading from his new collection of poems, "Any Rough Times Are Now Behind You." Well, a real lucky in love poem, huh? Dave Alvin, our listeners who know your work know your music. When did you start writing poems?
I actually started writing poems in college, seriously. You know, I wrote when I was a kid, but I had some great teachers at the Long Beach State University Creative Writing Department, Gerald Lachlan, Elliot Freed, and Richard Lee. And it was before I ever wrote songs or anything. And because of their, especially Elliot Freed was very strict about training us to write sonnets and Alexandrines and blank verse, that when I started the Blasters with my brother and started writing songs, it was very easy to write songs. Poetry's a little more difficult, though, for me.
What do you think you're doing in poems that is different from what you're doing in lyrics?
Well, I can get a little more personal. It would be hard to write something like that and make it. I don't know, maybe you could make it a hit song these days. I don't know. But I think I can maybe be a little more, I don't know what the word, I want to say real, but that's such a useless word. I can be even more honest, in a poem.
The poem that you just read, I have to ask you if a couple of things really happened. Were you really kidnapped by a 300-pound man in a purple negligee?
Yeah.
What happened?
I was sitting in a car. It was a really hot day in Los Angeles, and the woman... my girlfriend at the time was inside a store, and there was no parking in front of the store, so I went around the corner, and like I said, it was about 90 degrees. I had the windows down, and next thing you know, I had a passenger.
and he got the wheel from you?
He told me to drive, and so I drove, and we were driving down the street, and we were passing the store where my girlfriend at the time was standing. And she's like looking at me like, "Oh, who's your friend?" And right at the same time, there was a policeman giving somebody a jaywalking ticket, and so my passenger and I had a little conversation about the policeman, and then it was one of those situations where I decided I'm going to try to steer the car into the policeman's motorcycle. That'll get his attention, and so we fought over the wheel at that point.
And
the rest is criminal history.
How did you get the officer's attention?
We drove the car into the motorcycle.
And he didn't sue you for that, I hope.
No.
And getting back to the poem again, how sick were you when you had the meningitis?
I was pretty sick.
How'd you get it?
Well, they came into the room one day in the hospital and they said, "We need to know every place you've been and everyone you've had contact with in any way for the past 2 weeks." And so... they gave me a phone, and it became kind of like a Raymond Chandler thing because I was touring at the time. So it was like calling various cities and, informing the musicians that I was touring with and, blah, 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 people I had met, people I talked to backstage. And we finally tracked it down to there had been an outbreak of meningitis in Santa Cruz where I'd played. And there was one of those backstage scenes after the gig. And... there was a woman back there, and it was like 2:30 in the morning, and this is really, this just doesn't make me sound good at all, but we were out of beer, okay? And it was 2:30 in the morning, and this woman that was visiting backstage, one of the other guys in the band, had like a half-full beer, and she wasn't drinking it. And I said, "Are you done with that beer?" And she said, "Yeah, you can have it." So I finished her beer, and the rest is medical history.
Wow.
And then what was really funny was I called her up, and once we traced it, and I said, "Do you have these symptoms, blah, 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 blah." And she goes, yeah, I feel horrible. I feel horrible. And I was like, "Yeah, well, look, I'm in the Oakland, Kaiser Hospital in Oakland, California, and, I've got meningitis, and you should probably go, check into a hospital immediately." She goes, "No, I don't. I don't have meningitis. No, I don't. You know, you have all the symptoms. No, I'm not sick. I'm not sick. I never heard of you. Goodbye. You know. So hopefully she made it through. I don't know.
Well, that's the last time you'll share a beer, huh?
It has. That was the last time I shared a beer.
Yeah. So was there
something... It's like stupid ways to catch great diseases, you know.
What set off this poem? Was there a specific last straw that made you sit down and write it?
It is actually, all that stuff took place a while ago.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes, for me anyway, I like to let things gestate. When I write about something when it's happening, it tends to be overly emotional or bad. And it's one of the reasons I don't make a lot of records, because I like to let what's going on in my life gestate. Is that the word?
Yeah.
And so it kind of sat around me for about 4 years. And then one evening, I found the old fortune cookie that said, any rough times are now behind you. And I was trying to remember, where did I get this? Why did I have this? I was like, oh, yeah. You know, and when I had gotten the fortune cookie, when I got the fortune, I said, I'm going to keep this for the rest of my life now.
And, of course, was the prediction true? It's just been a happy ending ever since.
Oh, yeah. I've never been happier.
Now, did you read much poetry when you were young?
Yeah, I did, not a lot. I did some. Where I went to school in Long Beach, there was a little poetry scene that Lachlan and Freed were kind of the patron saints of, or maybe Bukowski was the patron saint. But there was there was such a good writing department that a lot of writers went through there. In those days, this was, you know, getting to be way back there. It was kind of fun. You know, you drink a beer and read a poem, and then your teacher would drink a beer with you and read his poems, and it was fun. You know,
were the worlds of music and poetry usually two separate worlds for you?
Yeah, a lot of musicians don't understand poetry, and a lot of poets don't understand musicians, and they're pretty much the same thing. A lot of my songwriting influences have been more literary than songwriterly. You know, when I write lyrics for a song, I'm thinking as much about Raymond Chandler or Ernest Hemingway as I am thinking about Chuck Berry or Bob Dylan.
You know, it seems to me if you're reading even if you're reading poetry at a bar, let alone at a bookstore, that there's much less that separates you from the audience than at a club.
Yeah.
You know, first of all, you have all the equipments, you know, the instruments and everything separating you from the audience. And second of all, it's just a different atmosphere. You're much more accessible at a poetry reading.
Yeah. I actually don't like doing poetry readings, so.
For that reason? Or?
Yeah. And I liked them when I was young, when I was in college. They were fun because they were kind of a way of, you know, like, screaming, you know, and getting a lot of those, you know, confused emotions you have at that age. It was a way of getting them out, and it was a way of, especially with the teachers I had, it was a way of feeling like that I came from someplace, that I was somebody. And I think that that's one of the great things that poetry can do for just, you know, everyone once they start writing it, is it helps you to define yourself. And but now it's gotten to a point where if I don't have a guitar on, it's not that I feel naked. It's just that I don't think I'm very good at it. You know, there are some people that, you know, Henry Rollins, for instance, is great at performing his work. And that's, you know, not something that I wouldn't put myself down the Dylan Thomas category of inspired readers, you know.
My guest is Dave Alvin. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with roots rock performer Dave Alvin. His book of poems is called Any Rough Times Are Now Behind You. Did you, when you were in school, go through the lyrics as poetry scare? Were your teachers were hand out Xeroxes of Bob Dylan or Simon and Garfunkel?
Yeah, they do that. Except because I went to a Catholic school, they would always be, they wanted to interpret all the lyrics of rock and roll songs in a religious context.
Oh, that's great.
So the teachers would bring in, the brothers would bring in Aqualung or a record like that and, you know, talk about, you know, Aqualung in relationship to Catholicism. And it would just be, you know, and then the kids are all looking at each other because they're out, you know, smoking pot or something in the parking lot listening to it, and they're not thinking of anything like that.
Yeah. There's another poem I want you to read for us.
Yeah.
This is a poem about Charles Bukowski.
Yeah.
But before you read it, tell us why you wrote it.
When he passed away, Linda Bukowski, his wife, asked me and about eight other writers to write sort of remembrances or tributes to him for a magazine, a poetry magazine out in L.A. called Caffeine. And so I was real honored that Linda thought of me for that. And that's another true story, and it does involve the same person from the other poem.
I'm glad you said that. I thought this was two really bad back-to-back relationships.
Oh, no, no. No, I think I can mine this one for another 10 years. Every time I get up, I think of something else that was horrible about it. And I should be fair and say that she's probably writing poems that are as accurate about me being as no good as mine are. You want to do it now?
Yeah, why don't you read it?
It's a poem for Charles Bukowski. I once lived with a woman who owned doubles of every F. Scott Fitzgerald book. If you really loved me, she'd say, you'd burn your Bukowski books. Already in the name of love, I'd quit smoking in the bedroom, stopped talking to most of my close friends, and thrown away a small collection of porno magazines and even an autographed copy of Bob Flanagan's S&M Love Sonnets. But the Bukowski books was where I drew the line. No, I'd tell her. And sometimes that ended the discussion, and sometimes it didn't. When it didn't, she'd harangue me with all the criticisms usually thrown at Bukowski, like a non-smoker preaching the evils of secondhand smoke. And I, like a smoker praising the joys of tobacco, tried to explain what it was like when I saw him read at my first poetry reading in a small bar in Long Beach in the mid-1970s. I tried to explain what it was like seeing an old white guy as tough and cool as the old black bluesman I'd grown up seeing. How the bar was so crowded that all I could see above the drunks and hecklers, the English professors and the students, and all the young men pretending they'd seen and done all that old men had, was his head. His face scarred and unshaven, hair greasy and combed back, the kind of face you used to see on the old men in the old bars on the old streets like Western, Atlantic, and Vermont. I tried to explain what it was like seeing a man who, at a time when rock and roll meant nothing and everyone said, have a nice day, understood the silent madness of an empty room. A man who understood men like my father, men who passed out drunk at kitchen tables or on bathroom floors, who spit out chunks of their lungs while fumbling for another cigarette, men who felt so much they prayed to feel nothing. But I tried hardest to explain to her how I left the bar that night with words pounding in my skull for the first time like a good rock and roll song. His words, words like nothing I'd been taught in school, but had felt every day of my life. And I tried to tell her how from then on I wanted to write poems, songs, anything, and how like the old blues man gave me music, Bukowski gave me words. I never burned my Bukowski books, and I haven't seen the woman I lived with in years. I guess I really didn't love her.
I like that poem.
Thanks.
And I'm wondering if you think singing has helped you read your poems.
No, it's probably hurt. I probably read better before I sang.
You think so?
Yeah. Yeah, because before I used to actually enjoy poetry reading a lot before I started singing because it was my only outlet that I could, you know, it was the only way I could get my words out through my voice. Because in the Blasters or the time I was in X, you know, my brother Phil was doing all the vocals, or John and X Zine, and so I loved to do poetry readings back then because it was more like, okay, it's my turn now, you know. And now my rhythm is more of a singer's rhythm than a poet's rhythm, and as far as reading, If I was to spend maybe a year practicing, I might get pretty good at it. I don't know, but yeah. Maybe with the next book.
You know, I sometimes think that even if I fancied myself a writer, and even if I could write really well, that I might not have the taste to write anything truly autobiographical, because I'd be so self-conscious about not only revealing my own secrets, but the secrets of the people who I've known well and would be writing about. And I wonder if that's been hard for you, like the work you read for us today. The woman you referred to is a real person. I mean, is it hard for you to write about her in that way?
Well, in some ways, yeah, it is, but it's almost... because they're short poems, it's you almost cartoon it, if you know what I mean. She's actually a really great person from a great family. It's just that we shouldn't have been together, and what I just said doesn't make for a good poem. You know what I mean?
I know exactly what you mean. Yeah.
So, knowing that, and usually when I write poems, is very late at night, and when my sensors are down, and. So I try not to think about it. Usually, my experience has been that when I've written a song about someone and they can figure it out, or even when I've written poems about them, even if it's, you know, not derogatory but honest, they tend to laugh or get, you know, feel complimented, you know. And I don't think, you know, I mean, if you read the whole book, I don't think I come off sounding like, you know, a Catholic priest in this book either, so it's not like I'm getting up scot-free. A Catholic priest handing out lyrics to Aqualung.
Dave Alvin recorded last March. Dave Alvin's book of poems is called Any Rough Times Are Now Behind You. He has a new album, his first live solo CD, called Interstate City. It's on High Tone Records. Here's a track from it called So Long Baby Goodbye. The song was written by Dave Alvin.
Well, I know I've been full of too long. I'm never right, but always wrong. Goodbye, baby, so long. And you know, you never let this thing catch on. You never let me be that strong. Goodbye, baby, so long. There was a cold wind blowing on the night of a man. Windows were rolled up tight. We both asked for something we could never get. Now I knew what's right. None of us are gonna cry. It wasn't even worth the try. So long, baby, goodbye.
Coming up, Maureen Carrigan reviews a new novel by criminal lawyer Paula Sharp. This is Fresh Air. Popular literature written by lawyers tends to fit into the mystery thriller genre. Just think of books by John Grisham and Scott Turow. But although she's a criminal lawyer, acclaimed novelist Paula Sharp gravitates toward more psychological tales of family relationships gone askew. Book critic Maureen Carrigan has a review of her latest novel, Crows Over a Wheat Field.
Some novels, like Paula Sharp's Crows Over a Wheat Field, should be published without plot summaries on their book jackets. When I skimmed its flap and the words domestic violence and custody rulings popped out, I thought, oh no, another novel that reads like a TV movie of the week. I'll pass. But fortunately, curiosity triumphed over cynicism. And before I consigned Crows Over a Wheat Field to my library donation pile, I read its first paragraph, then its second and third. and I realized that this is a novel about wife battering and child abuse, the way Raymond Chandler's The Big Sleep is a novel about murder. Both transcend the limits of their social problem themes to offer readers a brooding, off-kilter vision of the American landscape in which evil reigns and the innocent will themselves into a self-protective numbness. Crows Over a Wheat Field ambitiously spans four decades, opening in the 1950s. Our narrator, a newly appointed federal judge named Melanie Ratlier, flashes back to her Midwestern childhood. In a deadpan voice, she recalls that within months of her mother's death, her father married his mistress and brought her and her son Matt into the house. Then Melanie's father, who was an eminent criminal defense attorney, began to terrorize his newly blended family, just as he had terrorized the old. None of the other fictional or autobiographical accounts of abuse that I've read have so vividly dramatized the atmosphere of uncertainty that its victims live in, the exhausting dread of wondering from minute to minute whether you're going to be humiliated or beaten. Melanie responds by retreating into obsessive daydreams. Her half-brother Matt turns to drugs, and one night he overdoses on LSD. His body recovers, but his mind is lost to schizophrenia. The second part of Crows Over a Wheat Field takes place in the mid-70s, when Melanie visits her stepmother, long since divorced from her father, and Matt in a tiny Wisconsin town. They've made friends there with a local minister and his hippie daughter, a funny, vibrant woman named Mildred, who's the mother of a 3-year-old boy. When Mildred's charismatic husband, Daniel, arrives back from a long research trip in the Amazon, Melanie feels erotically drawn to him. But Daniel slowly unveils a darker side. Daniel sadistically torments Mildred and his young son and prevents Matt, who adores the boy, from seeing him. Spurred on by memories of her father's violence, Melanie helps Mildred initiate divorce proceedings. But when a conservative judge threatens to give child custody to Daniel, Mildred grabs her son and goes underground for the next 15 years. This bare-bones synopsis doesn't do justice to the disturbing psychological power of Sharp's tale that's conveyed largely through images that radiate menace. One afternoon, for instance, Melanie spots Daniel leading his son out onto a barely frozen lake. She rescues the boy, but Daniel continues crossing to the far shore with what Melanie describes as easy gliding steps, like a water strider walking on water. In another passage, a mad entomologist tells Melanie that winters in Wisconsin are too chilling even for beetles to remain above ground. They cling to the sides of houses and the bottoms of rocks, he says, until the world makes sense again. In this novel, though, the world never does make sense. That's why Melanie finally abandons her legal career and follows Mildred underground to try to subvert a system that often further victimizes those who've suffered abuse. The bang-up ending of Crows Over a Wheat Field is supposed to be triumphant, but it's a testimony to the rest of this poetically bleak book to say that I couldn't quite buy it.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Crows Over a Wheat Field by Paula Sharp. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Roberta Shurrock, with Barbara Bogave. Research assistance from Siobhan Roth. Alan Too directed the show. Fresh Air's theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Bonnie Raitt plays some of the blues recordings that most influenced her own development as a singer and guitarist. We'll also hear from her father, John Raitt, who used to be a leading man in Broadway musicals. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.